Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It's April the 22nd, and we are in Shmuel Bays, and we're up to Perek Tesvav, Chapter 15. So, we have Avshalom back in Yerushalayim, and finally the king agreed to see him, and now we're going to see the actual rebellion of Avshalom. Vayihi me'acharei chen, it was after this, vayas lo Avshalom merkava v'susim, and Avshalom made for himself a chariot and horses, v'chamishim ish rotzim lefanav, and 50 men running in front of him. It was a common practice in their day that a sign of prestige was to have runners running before the chariot. V'hishkim Avshalom would get up early. This was a daily thing. V'amad al yad derech hashar, and he would stand on the side of the road to the gate, meaning the gate to go see the king's court. V'yihi kol ha'isha sheyelo riv lavo el ha'melech la'mishpat, and it was every man who had a fight to come to the king for judgment. So he had some issue with somebody else and he was going to the king for judgment. Vayikra Avshalom elav vayomer, Avshalom would call to him and say, Emi zeh yirato, what city are you from? Vayomer, and he said, Me'achad shivtei Yisrael avdecha, your servant is from one of the tribes of the Jewish people. Vayomer elav Avshalom, and Avshalom would say to him, Rei dvarecha tovim unechochim, see your words are good and they make sense. And you don't have anybody to hear you. You have nobody to validate you from the king. Vayomer Avshalom, Avshalom would say, Mi yisimeni shofet ba'aretz, who can make me a judge in the land, that I should be a judge in the land? And to me, anybody who has a fight and a judgment would come. V'hitz daktiv, and I would make him righteous. V'haya bikrov ish lishtach avoslo, and it was when a man would come close to bow to him. V'shalach es yado, Avshalom would send forth his hand, v'hachaziklo, and grab hold of him, v'noshaklo, and kiss him. V'yas Avshalom kadavar hazel l'chol Yisrael, Avshalom would do like this for all the Jewish people. Eshe yavo l'amishpat el ha'melech, that would come for judgment to the king. V'yiganev Avshalom eslev anshei Yisrael, and Avshalom stole the heart of the men of Yisrael.
Did they know who he was?
Oh yes, yeah. They knew full well who he was. And Avshalom here does what he's appealing to people. Who is he appealing to?
The people who came for a judgment.
Yeah, but those are, what types of people are they?
Common people.
With disputes.
With disputes. So he's appealing to people who are disgruntled, who have something that they're upset about. So he has an audience when people are upset about something, and if you can validate them, then you are automatically considered highly considered in their eyes, right, as you've given them like to stand on.
Right. Chapter
15. Avshalom is what we call the opposition party. He's not an overt opposition party. See, it's very easy to be the opposition party. The opposition party is a very easy place to be because you can say whatever you want and you have no responsibilities. You don't need to put your money where your mouth is. You don't need to do anything to make things better. All you have to do is complain. And so it's very easy to be the opposition party. It's no great feat to just complain about everything. It's much harder to solve problems than it is to complain. And here, Avshalom is not the opposition party in the sense of going around complaining about the king's policies, but he is taking advantage of people who are upset and saying, oh, you know, if I would, you know, you have such a great argument, you make a lot of sense, and if only I would be in charge. Mm. And of course, anybody who hears that who was just validated by him agrees wholeheartedly, if only he would be in charge. Yeah. Avshalom was very good at this. He charmed people in this way. And you see, as the Navi describes, he would listen, he would hear them out, he would validate them, they would come forward to bow to him, and instead of allowing them to bow, he would kiss them, showing them, treating them as more of an equal than as a subservient. All the things that are necessary to make people believe that he would be a great leader, that he would be the much better if he was in position of power than if David were in position of power. He doesn't need to tell anybody what to do. He doesn't need to exert any authority. All he does is he uses their state of mind and also his position, because they all know he's the prince. And through this, as the Navi says, he stole the heart of the Jewish people. We will see later that Avshalom actually stole three different hearts. This is the heart of the Jewish people, which is one of the three hearts that he stole. We'll see later that there's three different hearts. The heart, obviously, here doesn't mean an individual heart, but it means there's three types of ways that he stole people's heart. And this is one of them. Avshalom, his tactic works, and people become enamored with him. He becomes the champion of the underdog. He becomes the one who you turn to when you really have trouble. And slowly but surely, he does this every day, gets up early, and he's there every day. So everybody who comes, by and large, they're going to come in contact with Avshalom and his charming ways. And all they're going to hear from him is, boy, you're really wonderful, you're right, everything's great, you should have a better argument. It's unfortunate no one's taking care of you. That's what he's doing.
Is he usurping the Sanhedrin?
He's usurping everybody.
Because he would normally, the Sanhedrin is usually by the gate sometimes.
Well, he gets them before they get there. This is before he gets there. David HaMelech is in charge. This is before they get there. Mm-hmm.
He's at the way of the gate.
He's not, you know. Now, in order to be able to do this, besides being charming and besides having a position, there's something else that you need. He does this every single day.
He doesn't have another job to go to.
Right. He's not gainfully employed.
He's got a lot of time on his hands.
He doesn't need to be anywhere. He's the prince, and he's got time, and he's able to use it to further his own ambitions.
You know, this makes an interesting contrast with David HaMelech, who spent so many years running around and being chased and hiding and fighting battles before that and after that, and he had a lot to do.
Right. Avshalom would not win on the platform of war veteran.
Yeah. Right?
That he wouldn't win on. Right? David would win on that platform.
Or accomplishments.
Right. But in charm, and not just charm, but knowing how to ingratiate himself to people, and knowing how to push the right buttons with people.
Is it people or just men?
Well, I mean, the women weren't coming to court, so it was likely it was just men. I mean, it doesn't say anything about the women over here. Okay, so he's setting the stage. He hasn't done anything yet, but he's setting the stage.
And women aren't going to go to arms for him either.
No. Now, this goes on for a long time. It's unclear exactly at what point in David's reign this starts. But Avshalom will rebel in the 36th year of David HaMelech's reign. 35th, 36th, it's unclear exactly, but about the 36th year. David ruled for 40 years. So Avshalom will rebel towards the end of David's, not the very, very end, but towards the end of David's reign. Where we are up to in David's reign is a little bit unclear over here. We've had many stories about David until this point. How much time has elapsed? We know that Shlomo HaMelech is going to be 12 years old when he takes over. So how old is Shlomo when Avshalom begins this process? Remember, Avshalom was away for 2 years. So it's not exactly clear, but this is not a one-day thing. This goes on for a very long period of time that Avshalom is slowly gaining popularity. The pasuk says in Zion 7, "Vayehi miketz arba'im shana." It was at the end of 40 years. "Vayomer Avshalom el Hamelach." Avshalom said to the king, "El chana, I will go va'ashalim es nidri, and I will pay my fulfill my oath asher nadarti laHashem beChevron, that I took an oath to Hashem in Chevron." Now this pasuk needs a lot of explanation. First of all, 40 years from what? At the end of 40 years. This wasn't going on for 40 years. So what does it mean, 40 years from what? And what oath did he take? And when was he ever in Chevron? He may have been in Chevron, but we never heard about him being in Chevron. So what does this mean? What is the whole pasuk talking about? Let's read one more pasuk, then we'll come back to this. Ki neder nadar avdecha, for your servant took an oath, b'shivti v'gshur ba'aram, when I dwelled in Geshur in Aram, remember when he was in exile, lemor, saying, im yashuv yeshiveni Hashem Yerushalayim, if Hashem will return me to Yerushalayim, v'avarti es Hashem, and I will serve Hashem, which means that I will bring sacrifices. So this is an overt contradiction between the two psukim, two verses, because the previous one says that he took an oath in Chevron. The Pasuk Ches, verse 8, says he took an oath when he was in exile in Geshur, in Aram.
Why was he in exile? Who put him in exile?
Remember, he ran away after killing Amnon. So he ran away. So the Gemara says that this was an oath that he took when he was in Geshur. And what it means, that the oath that I took to Hashem in Chevron, it means the oath that I took to Hashem that I would bring a sacrifice from the sheep that are in Chevron. The Gemara says that Chevron's livestock was particularly were particularly healthy and good. It was good grazing land in Chevron. The reason why it was good grazing land is because Chevron is actually not a very hospitable terrain for farming. There are grassy areas, but it's not flat and there's a lot of rocks, so it's not very hospitable to farming. And since it's not hospitable to farming, therefore it's a good place for grazing, because grazing, you don't need a nice flat expanse. You can have a little bit of a rocky area that's not good for farming, but still, as long as you have some vegetation growing, you can graze animals. And so it was considered to be a good place to find raise livestock, and there were good healthy animals there to bring for carbono. So his oath to Hashem was, I will bring sacrifices from Chevron. Now, whether he actually took this oath or not is unclear. He may have taken such an oath, but clearly this is going to be his way of taking over, because he's going to use Chevron as his platform from where to mount the rebellion. You can't, where are you going to mount your rebellion from? If you're going to, you know, if you're in the United States and you want to mount a rebellion from Pocatello, Idaho, you're not really going to get a lot of traction. It doesn't sound very appealing, right? You're going to use New York City. You're going to use something, you know, something, an important city lends importance to you. So here he says, he's going to try to start this thing from Chevron, where he is going to have some name recognition, and it's going to make sense. The prince is in Chevron. Chevron is where David started. Chevron is the special city. Everybody knows that. So there's a lot of name recognition in Chevron. What does it mean, the end of 40 years? Now, this is very, very important, what it means here, the end of 40 years. It does not mean 40 years from when Avshalom began this process. As we mentioned, it was a long time, but it wasn't 40 years. It also doesn't mean the 40th year of David's reign, because it's going to be clear, even though it's going to take us a while to get through the story of Avshalom, but after we do get through the story of Avshalom, there's still going to be several years left to David's reign, and he only ruled for 40 years. So it can't be this means the 40th year of David's reign. Therefore, the Gemara says this means the 40th year from when the Jewish people asked Shmuel for a king. The 40th year from when the Jewish people asked Shmuel for a king, that is when Avshalom is going to rebel. And as the Gemara says, that from the time that the Jews asked for a king until here, there had never been this sort of rebellion. Even though we did have Shaul losing his throne to David, but there was never an overt usurping of the throne. Remember, David never did that. David was very, very careful not to push his way into the throne. He let Hashem take care of Shaul. That a person with ambition should usurp the king and take over, that has not happened since the time we had a king. And it's been 40 years. So it's been 40 years after 40 years of a stable monarchy, or at least a monarchy that never had a rebellion, the monarchy here hits a significant bump in the road. Somebody usurps the throne. David is going to be on the run. The popularity will shift to Avshalom, and he will actually, for a time, appear like he will be successful in his rebellion. So if you look at the monarchy of the Jewish people, this is a low point. The monarchy, starting with Shaul, is a dip, and then you have David, and here's a very significant dip in the monarchy. So it's 40 years from when we asked for a king, you have this rebellion. Tosfos says, though, okay, fine. So it's 40 years since we asked for a king. Now there's a rebellion. Very interesting. What's the import of that?
Because Hashem wasn't happy when we came to ask for a king.
So, very good. So Tosfos says, when we asked for a king, if you'll recall, we were wrong for asking. Even though there would come a time when it would be ripe to ask for a king, we jumped the gun. We should not have asked when we did. When we did ask, it was a time when Shmuel was running the show. He was running it with vigor, and Shmuel was greater than any king we were going to have. Shmuel was of the greatest prophets that ever lived. He's on the level of Moshe and Aaron, Shmuel is. And we asked for a king in the prime of Shmuel's leadership, which was the wrong thing to do. We jumped the gun. But remember, if you'll recall, back when we did that, Hashem says to Shmuel, Shmuel is very upset that the Jews asked for a king, and he says to Hashem, he's upset about it, and then Hashem says to Shmuel, I'm reading, if you want to look at it, back in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Ches, chapter 8, Pasuk Zayin, verse 7, Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel, Hashem says to Shmuel, Shma b'kol ha'am, listen to the voice of the nation, l'chol asher yomru elecha, to all that they say to you. Ki lo oscha ma'asu, they haven't rejected you, ki osi ma'asu mimloch aleihem, it is me they are rejecting from ruling over them. Hashem says, this jumping the gun and asking for a king is not a reflection on you, Shmuel, it's a reflection on me. They don't want me to rule them in a more sublime way through a Navi. They want a king like all the other nations of the world. They're rejecting me, they're not rejecting you. Says Tosfos, 40 years before Avshalom, we as a people were morayed, we rebelled against Hashem in asking for a king. 40 years later, the king that we asked for, meaning monarchy, will be rebelled against. 40 is a number that implies creation, creativity. The Gemara tells us that from the time of conception, it takes 40 days for there to be a viable fetus, to be a recognizable fetus. Modern medical science has proven this to be correct. We don't need them to prove that it's correct, but they have corroborated it in their research, that it is approximately the 40th day when you have a clear form of some sort of a fetus. The Gemara says that, for example, the reason why the Mabul, with the flood, the reason why it rained for 40 days and 40 nights is because since one of the reasons for, the main reason for the Mabul, for the flood, was because of all the immorality that was going on, and Hashem said, you caused me to create illegitimate children, Mamzerim, so I'm going to destroy you with 40 days of rain, because it's a 40-day creation process. Well, it's going to be a 40-day destructive process. Or you can look at it as 40 days of creating a new world, if you want to look at it that way. The Torah was received in 40 days by Moshe Rabbeinu up on Har Sinai, because that's the amount of time it takes for the creative process to go from a world without Torah to a world with Torah, which is a completely different place to exist. It's a completely different existence. The Meraglim, the spies who went for 40 days, and as a result we were in the Midbar for 40 years. That 40 years was a process of destroying the old and bringing in the new, ushering the new, replacing the old with the new. That's what the number 40 tends to represent. So here it's a 40-year process where it comes full circle. We rebelled against Hashem. The monarchy has, so to speak, come of age. In the 40th year, there's a rebellion against the monarchy itself. That's how Tosus characterizes this 40-year span.
Two questions. One is, when we say that David reigned for 40 years, do we count from when he was anointed or when he was actually considered the king? He's the only king possible.
Yeah, when he was considered the king. It seems that, because it says he ruled in Hebron first, okay, and then Yerushalayim.
And how old is Avshalom at this time?
I don't know.
He was born before that, so
yes,
he could be 40 at this point.
He could be. I don't know how old he was. Chazal make it clear, the calculation I just told you, what Chazal say in the Gemara, but I don't know how old he was. It's a good question.
But if there was something to be done, why wouldn't a king or a prophet do it? Why would the king's firstborn be the one to make that offering of peace to Hashem?
I mean, he's...
Because he said to the 40th year, he's talking to David, right?
No, he doesn't say anything about the 40th year. It just says in the Navi, at the end of the 40th year, meaning 40 years from that rebellion, from the final time we asked for a king, we're now going to have rebellion. And all of Shalom says to the king is, I want to go pay off my debt. He doesn't mention the number 40. It's the Navi that tells us you should know this rebellion we're about to read about.
The king somehow knows what the debt is.
You know, he says that I took an oath when I was in Geshur.
He doesn't say really what the oath was about.
Yeah. It's understood that it means to bring a carbon. That would be the default of an oath, would be to bring a carbon. When you have a Beis HaMikdash, or at least when you have a Mizbeach, that would be the default oath to say.
Could we review for a minute who Avshalom's mother was? She was the captive, right, from Aram?
Ma'acha. Yeah. Ma'acha, the daughter of
King of Aram, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the rebellious son coming from the
captured. Yes, we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
Pasuk 10, verse 9, Vayomer lo ha-melech leich bishalom. The king said, go in peace. I have it in my pocket. The king says, go in peace. Vayakam, vayelech chevrona. And he got up and he went to Hebron. The Gemara says from here, we do not say the phrase Lech Bishalom, go in peace, to a person, because these words that David says to Avshalom are the last words that David will say to Avshalom, because from here will ensue the rebellion, and eventually Avshalom will be killed in the course of the rebellion. We say is Lech Lishalom, go to peace. We only say Lech Bishalom, go in peace, when we are talking to someone who has already passed away. There, when talking to the deceased, we say Lech Bishalom. But we don't say Lech Bishalom to someone who is alive. We say Lech Lishalom, go to peace, not go in peace. Pasuk verse 10. Vayishlach Avshalom Meraglim. Avshalom sent, now Meraglim, you know, means spies, but it means, this is not to spy out the land. These are his his servants, his henchmen. They're not gonna fight, but you'll see they're going to be his people who are going to rally everybody around him. So he sends his people, Bechol Shivtei Yisrael, and all the tribes of Yisrael, Lamar saying, Kishamachem es kol ha-shofar, when you hear the sound of the shofar, Vamartem, you shall say, Malach Avshalom Bechevron. Avshalom has become king in Hebron. So he's very clever, Avshalom. He's not doing this by the seat of his pants. He's got this all planned out. He's managed to gain great popularity amongst the people, but that doesn't mean that everybody's planning a rebellion. He's created some discontent where people are thinking, you know, Avshalom really would be a better king than David. Maybe no one's even saying it, but it's playing on their minds. And he then has his very close supporters spread out amongst the entire Jewish people all throughout Israel. And Avshalom is going to blow a shofar at some point, and there'll be a shofar, how do you say it? Where one person blows a shofar, the next person blows a shofar.
A relay,
right. Because it'll spread around. It'll be a siren that'll spread around all of Eretz Yisrael. And when you hear that happening, the succession of shofros, you'll know that's the time, and you should announce, Avshalom has become king in Hebron. And he's hoping, and he's correct, that what's going to happen is those who really wanted that to happen will become very excited and just, you know, start to celebrate, which will sweep other people in, and he will successfully rebel. Those who will be the dissenters, who will be the supporters of David, will be the minority, and they will be killed, and Avshalom will firmly take hold of the monarchy. Yud Aleph 11. Thus Avshalom halchum asayim ish miYerushalayim, with Avshalom and 200 men from Yerushalayim, kiruim, who were invited, vahochem lissumam, and going with their simplicity, which means they didn't know. V'lo yadu kol dover, they didn't know anything. Now here we have Avshalom stealing the other hearts of the Jewish people. The Gemara in the Yerushalmi tells us that Avshalom went to David and he said, listen, you know, I'm going to Hebron to get my sheep, to go pay a debt, to go bring the sacrifices, but I don't want to go by myself. I'm the prince. I'd like to take some important people with me. I'm going to do a special thing. I'm going to bring a karban, and I'd like it to be with some important personages, not just me by myself. I'd like to bring some members of the Sanhedrin. So David wrote him a letter that said that two people of his choice, he could ask two people to come with him, and they should go with Avshalom. By order of David, they should go with Avshalom as he goes to Hebron. So Avshalom took that letter and showed it to two of the Talmidei Chachamim, the Sanhedrin, people of stature, people of leadership, and said, David would like you to accompany me. And they said, oh, okay, fine. And they went with him. Then he took the letter and showed it to two more people. And then two more people. And until he got 200 people. Showed it to 100 pairs of people, so that he ended up with 200 people with him going to Hebron. That's right. Going to Hebron. And these people did not know what was happening. But unwittingly, they lent credibility to Avshalom. They may not have thought that this is all about Avshalom, because after all, they're following the rules of the king. They're following the command of the king, of David. But people who saw Avshalom with 200 of the most prestigious, well-known people, those who had their faces on the paper every week, those who were known to be giving those Torah classes to thousands of students at a time, they were the ones who were his entourage. So to the rank and file who saw this procession, they're going to assume that Avshalom is supported by these people. So when the shofar blast is going to happen, no one's going to take time to ask, what are you 200 people doing here? They're going to assume, oh, they must be in on it. They must be part of this.
And what did the 200 people think?
That at this point, they don't think anything. Yeah. They don't know anything. That's what it says. They don't know anything that's going on.
But if you read a letter that said two, and there's 200 now, you're not going to question it?
It could be that there were 100 other letters. And they don't know the circumstances why the other ones are here.
And they don't talk to each other.
Yeah. With the prince, I don't know, you know, he managed, he finessed it. He finessed it. You know, he's a very
extremely clever.
He's very clever, and he's got a lot of charisma and a lot of finesse, and he finessed it. He managed to do it.
Maybe he sent two at a time ahead of him and said, "I'll meet you there."
Could be.
Nobody ever saw each other.
Could be. Could be. Could be. I don't know, but he pulled it off.
So that's the heart of these people.
So here he stole the heart of David because he tricked his father, and he stole the heart of the Sanhedrin because a lot of these members who were with him were members of the Sanhedrin. So he stole, the Gemara says he stole three hearts, the heart of David, the heart of the Sanhedrin, and the heart of the Jewish people in general. And it seems that this term, Vayignov, he stole, which is what the term the Navi used, we use that term figuratively. You know, we use it when a person is in love, right? You know, he stole her heart, right? That's, we use it in the positive, in that way. But it can also be used, we use it figuratively in the negative. You know, like to
deceive someone.
Deceive, right. We use that term to steal, in Hebrew for sure, gnevas das.
Yeah.
To steal a person's knowledge, to trick them. So the Gemara makes it, it says it very clearly, it's stealing the heart. It's an interesting term to use, to steal the heart. But the Gemara says three different hearts. And the Gemara says this is why, ultimately, in his demise, he's going to have three daggers stuck into his heart. And that's going to be, as a mida can I give me, the measure for measure for stealing three different hearts. So, in other words, when you stealing the hearts of the Jewish people, it's a lot more than three, but meaning there are three types of deceptions that he did. The deception of David in writing the letter, the deception of the 200 people who were with him in showing them the letter independently, and then the deception of the Jewish people in making them believe that he was going to be the answer to everything that they've ever needed. Pasuk Yud Beis 12. Vayishlach Avshalom es Achisofel Hagiloni Yoetz David. And Avshalom sent Achitofel the Giloni, the advisor of David, Meiro, from his city Migilo, from Gilo, Bezavcho es Hazvachim, when he, Avshalom, offered his sacrifices, which means that Avshalom now has enlisted Achitofel as well. Now this is also extremely significant. The 200 people lent credibility to Avshalom. Achitofel lends genius to Avshalom. Achitofel, as we will learn later on, we're going to learn it later in the rebellion, that asking Achitofel for advice was like asking Hashem directly. Achitofel was the well-known, hands-down genius of the Jewish people. Without question, the genius of the people. They all knew it. And Avshalom enlisted Achitofel, and Achitofel joined Avshalom. Vahi Akesher Amitz, and the connection was powerful. The Kesher here means the rebellion, was powerful. Vaham Holech Varav es Avshalom, and the nation was going and getting larger with Avshalom. They blew the shofars, and there was just a groundswell of support for Avshalom. Avshalom was riding a tide of popularity, and people supported him. Achitofel is himself an interesting person. He is going to lose his chelek in Olam Haba. He's going to lose his portion in the world to come.
Achitofel
is going to lose his portion of the world to come. Achitofel does not support. He is anti-David. Is Achitofel. Okay. Now, what makes it all the more striking is that Achitofel is also the grandfather I'm sorry, the father of Bathsheba.
Oh my goodness. Father, David's father-in-law?
Bathsheba Bas Eliam. No, the grandfather, of Bathsheba. He's his grandfather-in-law. Which means that by usurping David, he and supporting Avshalom, so he's not usurping the royal family, because Avshalom is from the royal family. But it means that usurping Shlomo as being the heir to the throne. Shlomo is his great-grandson. So Achitofel is willing to support Avshalom over his own great-grandson in being the next king. So that in itself is striking and needs explanation. What was Achitofel's motivation to support Avshalom? So this is something which we're not going to talk about this evening. We're going to talk significantly about Achitofel later. Achitofel is going to be front and center in this rebellion, and we'll discuss that. We'll discuss his motivation and what's driving him when we get to what happens with him. Right now, this is the only mention we have of him, is that we mention it in passing. He's with Avshalom, just to show all of the personages who are with Avshalom included the great Achitofel.
Just a technical question here. It says, as he offered the sacrifices, does this mean that Avshalom was carrying out
It does seem that way. It seems that he used the sacrifices almost as a coronation. Like this was his, you know, I'm offering the sacrifice. Hashem has saved me from my exile, brought me back here to all of you people, all
like
of you. He's brought me here to lead you to prosperity and
glory and all
glory,
that.
Glory, right.
But didn't he say in his letter that he was going to just going to go get the sheep in Hebron and he was going to do the sacrificing in Yerushalayim?
Right. So I'm not sure. He's going to come to Yerushalayim eventually, but he's not there yet. So if he did offer the sacrifices, he would not have done it in Yerushalayim. He would have done it. Now, the Mizbeach, the altar, was in Givon. But at this time, it wasn't yet in Yerushalayim. They didn't have Beis HaMikdash yet. But at this time, you also were allowed to use a bama. You were allowed to use a personal altar. So I'm not sure where Achitofel brought his sacrifices. Yud Gimel 13. Vayavo HaMagid al David Lemar, the newsbearer, the
messenger.
Well, huh?
Bearer of news.
Okay, came to David saying, "Hayalev ish Yisrael acharei Avshalom." The heart of the men of the Jews. It's the man of the Jewish people, but it means each man is after Avshalom, is with Avshalom. Now, this was David recognized this as a mortal threat. He understood right away that this was not. Like, let's see just how bad it is. He understood right away. He recognized Avshalom's popularity. He recognized Avshalom's charisma and his cleverness. And he knew right away that he was in mortal danger. He understood it. Vayomer David l'chol avadav. David said to all of his servants, Asher ito b'Yerushalayim, that were with him in Yerushalayim, Kumu v'nivracha, get up and let us escape. Ki lo siya lanu fleita mipnei Avshalom. Actually, it means get up and let us run away. Because we will not be able to escape before Avshalom. Maharul aleches, quickly, go, let's go. Penye maher v'hisiganu, lest he is quick and catches up with us. V'hidiach aleinu es hara'a, and he will put upon us the evil. V'hika ha'ir l'ficharev, and the city will be struck down by the sword. David understands that that Avshalom not only has the popular vote, he also has the manpower, and he has the military might to sack Yerushalayim and kill all the people. Vayomru avdei hamelech el hamelech, the servants of the king said to the king, Kechol asher yivchar adoni hamelech, anything that our master, the king, chooses, hinei avadecha, behold, here is your servant. And they've all, the people in Yerushalayim pledged their service to David. They're sticking with David. Vayetzei HaMelech v'chol beiso b'raglav, the king and all of his house went out with him. Vayazov HaMelech es eser nashim pilagshim lishmor habayis, and the king left behind 10 women who were concubines to guard the house. Now this is significant. We'll see later on that this is very important. Now, why did he leave behind? Why does it? I mean, so he felt he had to leave behind somebody. Couldn't just abandon ship. He needed to leave somebody behind. So the Navi tells us who did he leave behind? He left behind 10 women who were concubines. Now, the very fact that it says 10 women is redundant. If you tell me 10 concubines, they're obviously women. So why emphasize 10 women who are concubines?
But they were related to him.
It's true. But why emphasize that they were women?
Well, maybe because he hoped that if Avshalom entered the city, he would not put them to the sword.
Okay.
They were not opponents.
Okay, so the women in general were less at risk than the men. This was not an army that was pillaging and molesting people. That's not what was going on over here. They were Jews who were still God-fearing people. They weren't going around. And this was a rebellion to take over. But it was not some filthy army ransacking the town. That's not what was going on, number one. And number two, the women, they posed less of a threat. There was no sense that the women were going to stop the rebellion. And they weren't full wives. If they were full wives of David, well, then, you know, who are they going to support? But these were concubines. So there's no... The connection to David is very tenuous. So, okay, so he assumed that they would be left alone. And they are left alone. That's not what... Their fate is not going to be because that Avshalom is trying to, you know, get rid of the supporters of David. He is going to molest them, but not because of some kind of vendetta against... We'll see later what happens. But he leaves them behind because they're not targets. They're safe. Then nothing's going to happen to them. At least nothing should have happened to them in being left behind to take care of the palace.
Why 10?
I don't know. I don't know why 10. You're right. It's emphasized as well. Why 10? That's a good question. I don't know why 10.
A minion of them.
Yeah, we're minions, right? Right. It's a good question. I don't know the answer.
And these are all David's concubines?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
I have a question. Wouldn't he be afraid that Avshalom would want to take them as like wives to show that he's usurped the kingship?
That is what Avshalom is going to do. That is what Avshalom is going to do. But I think David felt that that was beneath Avshalom. Mm-hmm. Aside from the fact that it's a horrible sin, because it's his father's concubines.
Right. You're already rebelling against your father, which is a horrible sin. So, okay. I mean, he's going to do horrible sins has been proven.
But let me ask you, do you think Avshalom kept Shabbos?
Yeah.
I'm sure he kept Shabbos.
He's a Talmud Chacham.
Right. So I'm saying, you know, he's not going to just step out of line just because, right? So number one, I think he felt that Avshalom wouldn't do it because of the sin, but also because that step to do that would require a certain public display.
Yeah.
And that's not something you can't do this in private and prove, look, you know, right? He's going to do it publicly. I think David just didn't believe that would actually happen. It's going to be an incredibly brazen thing that Avshalom's going to do in this context. And I would assume that David just didn't. It never entered his mind that Avshalom would go that far.
Maybe another reason it wouldn't enter his mind is that Avshalom has already had a big event in his life where he murdered someone for trespassing into a forbidden sexual relationship.
The same with Amnon and Tamar.
This has come up before,
right?
You know, so you would one would think he would maybe be the last person
okay.
to engage.
Interesting.
In an intra-family, you know, in a relationship like that.
Interesting. He wouldn't cross that line. He would be the last person to cross that line.
This is the big event that we know about Avshalom, is that he killed Amnon over doing something like this, which would have been technically permitted, but didn't look good, and he didn't like it. And
And that's a good point. Pasuk Yud Zayin, verse 17. Vayetse Hamelech v'chol ha'am b'raglav, and the king and all the nation went out at his feet, I mean they all left, vayamdu beis hamerchak. And they stopped at a beis hamerchak, means a house of distance, which means they got a certain distance away from Yerushalayim. They weren't near Yerushalayim anymore. They weren't 100 miles away, but they were already a distance from Yerushalayim when they paused. So there was kind of a hustle to get out of Yerushalayim as quickly as possible, because who knew when Avshalom was going to march into the city. So they got away. Now they get far enough away, they kind of pause and take stock. And in taking stock, we're going to see now that David is going to, I don't want to say he gets organized, but he takes stock of who's with him and who's not with him, and you'll see he's going to start to strategize. The whole strategy so far was get out. Now David is going to apply other forms of strategy to try to prevent the real calamity. And all of his servants were passing with him. And all of the crazy and all of the placey. Now, who are the crazy and the placey? We'll get back to that in a moment. And all of the people from Gas, those are non-Jews, 600 men. Remember, David had been in Gas, and these are 600 non-Jews who joined David. Ashabau v'raglu migas, they had come to his feet from Gas. Over Malpnei HaMelech, passing by in front of the king. Now, these people from Gas are going to be the next subject. They're going to be the next subjects of the story. But let's pause here just to describe who the Crasi and Placi are. The literal translation of Crasi and Placi is the archers, and that's Crasi, and Placi is the, I'm not sure if there's a succinct English word for it,
slingers,
right. Okay, the slingers.
Like slingshot?
Slingshot or catapult, I'm not sure which one. But both the Crasi and Placi shoot projectiles, rather than fight with the sword, hand-to-hand combat. And they're skilled at it. The tribe of Yehuda, in warfare, are known to be archers. That's what they're known to be good at. And David himself, we'll see much later on, was the greatest archer of them all. And well, this is something.
He's also pretty good with the sling.
Yes, pretty good with the sling, right? And the sword. But as an archer, David was particularly skilled. And the Crasi and the Placi are different types of projectile throwers, shooters, etc. That's the simple translation. But the Gemara says Crasi or Placi refers to the Urim v'Tumim, refers to the Kohen Gadol and his breastplate. That's the other meaning of the Crasi or Placi, because Koris means to cut off, to cut sharply, and placey means pella, means like wonders. And the Kohen Gadol, when he would ask of the choshen, of the breastplate, he would ask a question, then he'd be answered with lights lighting up, etc., with the letters protruding, and he would know the answer to his question. And that was the Crasi Uplasi. So David had with him the Kohen Gadol, with the Crasi Uplasi, with the Urim V'Tumim, because the Kohen Gadol was in Yerushalayim as well. And he came with David. Now, who is the Kohen Gadol? This is also a very important subject. I'm not sure how much we're going to get through this evening. We're going to try to cover as much as we can, but we're going to discuss that as well, who the Kohen Gadol was. That's going to be very important here in the storyline.
Who are the Gittites?
So that's what we're going to talk about next. That's the next thing. They were not Jewish, the people from Gas, and we're going to talk about them next. Pasuk Yates, verse 19. Vayomer HaMelech al Itai Hagiti. The king said to Itai Hagiti. Itai Hagiti was a good friend of David's, who was not Jewish. Itai from Gas. He was the leader of the 600 non-Jews from Gas who were with David. Lama Seleich Gamata Itanu. Why should you also come with us? Shuv, go back. Veshev im HaMelech, and dwell with the king. David means Avshalom. He's already referring to Avshalom as the king. Ki nachri ata, for you are a foreigner. Now, what does he mean by that? So the Mepharshim, the commentaries say that what David is saying to Ittai is, look, we're on the run. And when you're on the run, you don't have provisions. You're going to need to live off the countryside. We're going to be at the mercy of the assistance of people on the road. That's who's going to help us? We're going to try to find those who are sympathetic to our cause and help us out. Well, it's one thing to help out your fellow Jew, but you're a non-Jew. It's going to be even harder for you to find sympathy as we run. Now, it's one thing for, you know, if David has a whole group of people, you know, a couple thousand people who are with him, and they stop at a farmhouse, help us out. Well, it could be the 600 would be subsumed in the 2,000, but who's going to be able to provide food for that many people? That's not the way it works. It doesn't work that you come as a group. When you're on the run, everybody kind of fans out, and you're asking people for help as you go. So you're going to knock on somebody's door. They're going to recognize you as a non-Jew. They're not going to be interested in helping you. You're not in a great position over here. And then he says to him, "V'gam gole ata." And even if you do want to run away, you do want to go into exile, you don't want to go back to Yerushalayim, you don't want to go to Avshalom, lim komecha, at least go back to Gas. Go back to your hometown, so that way at least there, you will get some sympathy. But don't stay here with me, because you're going to have a harder time than the rest of us. Tomol bo'echa, yesterday you came, v'hayom ani acha imanu l'leches, and now I'm going to afflict you as we go, meaning you're going to be afflicted as we go. Vani holech ala sharni holech, I'm going to go wherever I go, meaning I don't know where I'm going to end up. Shuv v'hashev esachecha, go and return with your brothers, imach with you, imach chesed v'emes, and return with your brothers the kindness and the truth, meaning that I hold of for you kindness and truth. You did kindness and truth for me in sticking with me all this time, and I appreciate it, and I am indebted to you, and I owe it to you. But don't do this. This is going to be too difficult for you.
This is what they did, or what he did.
David is saying, I hold myself indebted to your chesed and emes. But Vayan Itai es Hamelech, and Itai answered the king by Omar, and he said, Chai Hashem v'chei Adoni Hamelech, I swear by Hashem and by the life of my master the king. You notice he speaks correctly, putting Hashem first, David second. Ki bimkom asher yi Hashem Adoni Hamelech, the place where my master the king will be, im lemaves, im lechaim, whether it's for life, death or for life, ki sham ye avdecha, that's where your servant will be. So Ittai pledges his allegiance to the king. He is not leaving the king. Vayomer David al Ittai, and David said to Ittai, lech va'avor, go and pass, meaning pass. He stopped him as he was passing by. So what happens is, David stopped and now was taking stock of who was with him. And as people were passing by, he was noticing. So Ittai passed by, stopped him. He said, don't do this. And he said, I'm not leaving. He said, okay, fine. And now Ittai passes along. Vayavar Ittai Hagiti v'chol anashav, and Ittai Hagiti and all of his men, v'chol hataf, and all the children, asher ito, that were with him, they all passed by David.
Did he convert?
So he did not convert here. Question is, what happened later on?
Because for him to acknowledge Hashem first and then...
There is no question that Ittai is considered to be a tzaddik, right? Whether he actually converted or not, I don't know. Certainly not at this point. Now, we had Ittai before. I mentioned him to you, but he was not mentioned explicitly in the pasuk. But I mentioned him to you. Let me remind you a little bit, and maybe it'll jog your memory. You'll recall that there's a rule that if you have avodah zarah, if you have idolatry, something which was worshipped as idolatry, that item becomes prohibited to derive benefit from it. It's asur bahana. If it was offered as a gift, what's that?
The statue. the head, the crown, or something.
The crown. Like good, crown. Good, good, good. Good, you got it. So it becomes prohibited. However, an avodah zarah, an idolatry, can become batal. It can become null and void if those who worship it give it up. They degrade it. They say, forget it. You know, you're no longer my God, and throw it out. So then it loses its prohibition.
Its status as a
right. Right. A Jew cannot be mevatel on avodah zarah. A Jew can't make an avodah zarah null and void. Only a non-Jew can. So you recall that after they finally conquered Rabbas from Ammon, that they finally conquered that city with the whole story of Bathsheba and Uriah, that at the end they finally were ready to conquer it, and Yoav stopped right before he conquered, and he called David in, that David should be the one to finally destroy it. And David comes, and then they finally defeat it, and then they take the crown off of the king, and they put it on David's, they give it to David. So the at that time, the problem was, it was an avodah zarah. And how could David make use of it? So the Gemara tells us that Itai Hagiti came and was mevatol the avodah zarah. That it was, that he came and he nullified the avodah zarah. I'm just going to point to you where that was.
So the person who does that nullification, I missed that particular night, I'm sorry. The person who does that nullification doesn't have to be the same person who did the worship.
Correct. It's what it seems. That's what it seems. It seems that as long as he has possession of it or has control over it,
he can make a declaration,
yes,
and remove it.
That's right. Right.
And he removes it as an avodah zarah, or he removes it, or you just can't use it in any way at all?
It removes it as an avodah zarah. It's no longer an avodah zarah. It's at the end of Perek Yud Beis of chapter 12. It says in Pasuk Lamed, verse 30, Vayikachas ateres malka me'al rosho. They took this crown, umishkola kikar zahav ve'evin yakar. Remember we said it's a very, very heavy crown, because it wasn't on the head of the king, it was on the head of the avodah zarah. What's that? In Pasuk Lamed, verse 30. Vati al rosh David, and it was on the head of David. We talked about how it hovered over the head of David. And the Gemara tells us was Itai Hagiti who came and was mevatel it. He nullified it from being the avodah zarah. So David here, what would you say? How does he feel having trying to discourage Itai from coming? Then Itai insists on coming along. He's encouraged, right? See, David here is, it's very hard when his own son is rebelling, he's feeling terrible, and getting the encouragement of Itai is very, very significant. That's a really important thing for David.
Reminds me of Ruth and Naomi.
Right.
Just like another Yehuda connection.
I think if we think back, also Itai has 600 men, and wasn't there a time, like during when David was on the run, when he had that many?
Yeah.
He had something like 600 men at some point.
That's all he had at one point.
Right, so he's like back to those days. Knows that a fighting force of 600 men can actually accomplish something.
That's true. There are others. It's not just them. It's not only 600, but even right. So now we're not done him taking stock. We have to stop here for this week. But he's going to be taking stock further of who he has with him. First of all, the fighting force, but also his resources. What does he have? Who does he have? How can he strategize? And that's what he's going to be doing as we move along. So we haven't completed that part yet. That'll be next week, Mirtz Hashem. We'll complete his taking stock of his people, and also laying the seeds for the strategy, his counter strategy to Avshalom. Avshalom has the charisma. Avshalom has the popular vote. Avshalom has the might of the people. David is going to have to be just as crafty and clever to undermine the rebellion of Avshalom. So the balance of this perek is going to be discussing that. And then the next perek will be the actual carrying out of the various strategies of Avshalom and the strategies of David, and we'll see how they play out.
But you can't also miss the point that the smid of chesed that comes from Ruth and Naomi, the grandmother, comes now to David also to help.
Yes, yeah, that's a good point.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.